This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Today's show was pre-recorded, so we won't be able to take your questions and comments. Longtime political advisor and journalist Sidney Blumenthal has released the second of his four-volume biography of Abraham Lincoln. Wrestling with His Angel, The Political Life of Abraham Lincoln, Volume 2, 1849 to 1856, reveals the future president's genius during the most decisive period of his political life, when he seizes the moment, finds his voice, and helps create a new political party. Sidney, thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure.
Now, Volume 2 starts in 1849 and goes to 1856. What's the significance of this seven-year period in Lincoln's life?
This is Lincoln's dark night of the soul. Lincoln is in the wilderness. It takes a great revolution to bring him out of his wilderness. He goes through a period of despair, which he wonders whether his life has any point, and whether he confides to his law partner, William Henry Herndon, that he feels he will die and no one will ever know he lived. To his emergence to become the Abraham Lincoln we know in history. And this is the decisive period that frames him and distills the Lincoln that we know.
You're right that Lincoln sometimes depicts himself as becoming nearly indifferent to politics during this time in his life when he has this break in his public political career. But was that really the case?
Well, not really. Lincoln was positioning himself. I know we think of Lincoln as somebody on a pedestal, but he was a practical politician from the age of 23, and he never would have become the great emancipator had he not been the great politician. His law partner, Herndon, said his ambition was a little engine that knew no rest. He had finished his one term in the Congress in 1849. He had failed to get a federal patronage job. He had done everything wrong. He came to Lexington, Kentucky, sent by his wife to try and reclaim her family's fortune, lost the case. He watched as the anti-slavery forces were defeated in the state of Kentucky by a virulent pro-slavery movement that rewrote the state constitution and opened up the slave trade in Kentucky again. He was very bitter about it. It showed him the power of this pro-slavery movement. He smoldered about it. He returned to his law practice. He wandered around on his horses with names like Old Bob, from county courthouse to county courthouse in central Illinois, but he was always keeping his eye on national politics throughout the whole time, even though he was completely obscure and virtually unknown.
You talk about how his friends and his acquaintances would talk about these periods of melancholy that Lincoln would go through, but you say that those weren't so much just periods of melancholy as they were periods where Lincoln was thinking about things and really digesting things.
Lincoln suffered what we would call today clinical depression. I feel pretty safe in saying that. It was called melancholy in the 19th century. And he learned how to use that. He was an incredibly self-disciplined person. To begin with, he came from extreme poverty and turned himself into a lawyer, a congressman, a politician. And he was always working on his mind. When he was younger, he suffered from suicidal impulses. He had breakdowns. He had a breakdown after the death of his fiancée, Anne Rutledge, in New Salem. He had a breakdown in Springfield when his relationship with Mary Todd and their courtship wasn't working out. His friends, it was said, had to remove razors from his presence. But over time, he learned how to deal with this. So here he is. He's come back to Springfield. He's in a two-man law office above the post office. No one knows who he is. He's wildly ambitious. His perennial rival, Stephen A. Douglas, is the senator and one of the most dominant figures in national politics. He feels as though his life is worthless. But he's using this depression for concentration, for intellectual pursuit. He's using it to focus. So even though he suffers from prolonged silences that everyone around him notices, he's also thinking and working on the problems of the day.
You mentioned Lincoln's chief political rival, Stephen Douglas. How much was Lincoln keeping track of Douglas during this period of 1849 to 1856?
It's hard to underestimate the influence of Stephen A. Douglas on Abraham Lincoln. This was a rivalry that went back all the way to the beginning of Lincoln's political career, to the 1830s in Illinois. Douglas simply rose and rose and rose and became a U.S. senator. He was a presidential candidate and lost, but he was 37 years old. He ran in 1852, and he was running again. Without Douglas, there was no Lincoln. Douglas was so important on the national stage, and he was so ambitious. He wanted to be president, and he was willing to break down all of the conventions of politics to do it. And so he proposed, finally, the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which removed the line running across the country, except for Missouri, and repealed the Missouri Compromise. And that line prohibited slavery in the North. That blew up politics as it was known. And there developed a whole movement for politics against the extension of slavery in the territories. And that sprang Lincoln. But here's the thing. Douglas was from Illinois. And while people could debate Douglas in the Senate, no one could really challenge him on his home ground except someone from Illinois. And that someone was the most prominent Whig in a party that was disintegrating, and that was Abraham Lincoln. So he had to form a new movement, and he had Douglas always in his sights. And trailing after Douglas pulled him along. He was following a meteor.
So it's fair to say that Douglas was the tipping point. That's what finally drew Lincoln back into politics?
Douglas blew up politics. He torpedoed it out of his own ambition. He had, as people said, quoting from Shakespeare's Macbeth, vaulting ambition. Lincoln was ambitious too, just as ambitious. But Douglas was unlike Lincoln in that he was unprincipled, and he would do anything to advance himself. And so he thought he would get a transcontinental railroad out of the deal of opening up Kansas and Nebraska, and he was indifferent at the time to whether or not those states would be claimed as slave states. And if they were, the reason the Southerners supported this bill is that they wanted to tip the balance of political power in the country and add more representatives and senators and protect slavery, which was the greatest economic force in the country. It's hard to imagine, but the slaves themselves were worth more than any other economic property in the whole country, except for all of the real estate in the United States.
So Douglas thought he would get a Continental Railroad out of the deal. Is that why Chapter 3 of the book is titled The Art of the Deal, which of course is also the title of Donald Trump's book about negotiating?
Right. Some of the titles in my book I've adapted from other books. It's an irony. I don't actually know that Trump has ever accomplished any large deals, but Stephen A. Douglas was a master dealmaker. He was a skillful legislator. He had extensive networks in the centers of finance in Wall Street, State Street in Boston, the banks and lobbyists of Washington. And he used those to create the Compromise of 1850. And that bill, which he masterminded and was in charge of, he used to create the Illinois Central Railroad Act, which created a railroad from Chicago all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico. It was a Mississippi River on rails. It was the first federally chartered railroad, and it basically supercharged Chicago and created it as a modern city and a railroad hub, and was a catalyst for the American Industrial Revolution. Douglas was just a whirlwind. He thought of himself as the spirit of the age. He would describe himself as that. He called his movement Young America. He believed he embodied manifest destiny to the West, and he would also bribe people through his financial networks. And not only that, but he made himself rich. He owned the right-of-way land, the lakeshore land in Chicago, that he sold to the Illinois Central as part of the deal. So he outdid everybody. And Lincoln was just watching this, stunned, not only envious and resentful, but worried at what Douglas was doing to the country.
And speaking of titles, Sidney, where did the title Wrestling with His Angels come from?
Wrestling with His Angel, which is the title of this second volume of my four-volume work on the political life of Lincoln, comes from the story of Jacob in the Bible. Jacob wrestles through a long night with an angel. It's himself. And comes to a realization in the morning and adopts a new identity and a new name. His new name is Israel. And for Lincoln, this long night lasts years. He begins this as a stalwart Whig, confused, despairing about the state of democracy, which he thinks is in decline in the country, under siege from the slave power. And he emerges in the end as somebody new with a new identity. He founds the Illinois Republican Party. He becomes a Republican. He leads the anti-slavery political movement in Illinois. And that becomes the instrument that will carry him all the way to the presidency. So this is Lincoln becoming the man we know as Lincoln.
So Lincoln plays a crucial role in the founding of the Republican Party after the Whig Party collapses in 1852. They had another party that they had to work their way around, if I'm not mistaken. The Know-Nothings were in existence at that time, weren't they?
Yeah, the Know-Nothings are an anti-immigrant nativist party. After 1852, the Whigs suffered a defeat in the greatest landslide in American history to that point. Franklin Pierce was president. He was handsome and dashing and a Mexican war hero and a complete weakling. He was manipulated by his Secretary of War, who happened to be Jefferson Davis, later the president of the Confederacy. And the Whig Party collapsed. And in that collapse, and then after the Kansas-Nebraska Act, the Democrats split. And there were anti- and pro-slavery factions, North and South, but there were also anti-immigrant movements because the first great wave of immigration hit the United States from the Irish and the Germans, the potato famine and the failed liberal revolutions of 1848. And there was a mass migration of more than 3 million people to the United States. And the Know-Nothings believed that only native-born Protestants should hold public office in the United States. And they became a mass movement and then a political party called the American Party. Their slogan was, only Americans should govern America. And this confounded Lincoln. Lincoln was not a know-nothing. He despised the Know-Nothings. He wrote in a letter that those who follow the Know-Nothings should go to a country where despotism is pure, like Russia. He said that their hypocrisy was given without any alloy. It was pure. And he had to frame this new coalition as his own party was disintegrating beneath his feet. The Know-Nothings were a serious impediment. Lincoln would not criticize them in public because he wanted to draw their members into this anti-slavery coalition. So he worked behind the scenes with his operatives to undermine them in Chicago and throughout the state of Illinois. And finally, in the meeting, the conference to create a convention for the founding convention of the Illinois Republican Party, the issue came to a head. And it was a conference of newspaper editors. Newspaper editors were pretty partisan at the time, and they had invited Lincoln to be there, to be the political person there at the meeting. And the German newspaper editor, George Schneider, who edited a paper called Staatszeitung from Chicago, big paper, proposed an Know-Nothing plank. And the Know-Nothings, who were in the meeting, said they would bolt. And the whole project looked like it was going to fall apart. So Schneider said, let's let Lincoln decide. And Lincoln said, gentlemen, this is already decided. It's in the Declaration of Independence. You can't found a party on principles other than all men are created equal. And that settled the matter. And it was because of Lincoln's judgment and his presence that the Illinois Republican Party was created, and they overcame the hurdle of the division over this nativist movement, the Know-Nothings, and eventually defeated them and absorbed a lot of their members into the anti-slavery movement that became politically the Republican Party.
In writing your books about Lincoln, Sidney, what have you come to appreciate most about him?
Lincoln's character is one of somebody who is principled and yet practical. He comes to that from long experience, including tragic experience. His understanding of politics is an understanding not only of parties and issues and policies, but also of human nature. He knows how to size people up. He knows how to test them. He tests them with humor. He tells stories. He diverts them with tales. He studies logic late at night while the other lawyers are asleep in sharing rooms and boarding houses. Lincoln is described as reading the books of Euclid. Why would he study geometry? And the answer is he had almost no formal education. He was completely devoted to his own self-education. He was a self-made man. And he wanted to study logic not only to improve his lawyerly skills, but his political skills, how to frame an argument. The thing that Lincoln comes to here is that he redefines the politics. He pays very close attention. He understands the new circumstances. He spends a lot of time thinking them through. He reads a lot, and he speaks to the issues, in a particularly a very long speech in 1854 against the Kansas-Nebraska Act. And as a result of that, he emerges as a political leader. And that's a lesson for today as well.
Two more volumes to come in the series, is that right, Sidney?
Yes, two more. We'll see Lincoln as president, Lincoln grappling with greater difficulties than any other president has ever faced in the Civil War. We'll see Lincoln having to invent the instruments of power in order to reach his goals and to overcome opposition and criticism on all sides, and having to measure when he can issue an Emancipation Proclamation, how he can deal with a military that is undermining him and not listening to him and is almost an independent political force, and facing defeat, and how to marshal his forces amidst the greatest difficulties the nation's ever faced.
Sidney, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
Author Sidney Blumenthal discussing the second of his four-volume biography of Abraham Lincoln. Coming up after a short break, Cincinnati Zoo Director Thane Maynard talks with the CEO of the American Humane Association. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.